on May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans. That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. With over 350 million global monthly visitors, Indeed's matching engine helps you find quality candidates fast. You get to ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. It's not just about hiring faster, though. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Don't search. Match with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Listen, as you drive through most neighborhoods in America these days, you might notice something missing. The shrieks and laughter of kids playing outside. When my guest today had kids, he decided he wasn't going to let them grow up in another quiet, morgue-like neighborhood. Instead, he was going to figure out why kids weren't playing outside anymore and how to fix the problem. His name is Mike Lanza, and in his book, Playborhood, Turn Your Neighborhood into a Place for Play, he shares how he did just that. At the start of our conversation, Mike explains how he became an advocate for kids playing outside by themselves with minimal adult supervision. He shares his theories on why outdoor play has decreased and why simply limiting screen time and participation in organized extracurriculars doesn't solve the problem. Mike then explains why you need a critical mass of kids to be playing outside before outdoor play becomes a norm, and what parents can do to create this critical mass by changing the environment in their yard and the social dynamics in their neighborhood. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/playborhood. Mike Lanza, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you.
So you are the author of the book, Playborhood, Turn Your Neighborhood into a Place for Play. So tell us about this idea of Playborhood that you came up with. What's your story? How did this all come about?
Well, I was living in San Francisco with my wife back in the early 2000s. And we had just been, single adults having a great time in San Francisco. And when my wife became pregnant with our first child, who turned out to be a son, all of a sudden I realized, boy, I really don't know what childhood is like these days. I haven't really hung out with people who have kids very much. I've just been living in my own single world, urban single world, but I was an older father-to-be. I was 40 years old. So I had lots of friends who had kids, and I started paying attention and asking questions. And I remember one day I was at a friend's house, and it really hit me. Wow. My friend's son was arguing with him about, scheduling and being with this kid or being with that kid, where they were going. And it sounded awful to me. And I turned to my friend and I said, "So why doesn't he just go out and play?" And my friend said, "Oh, kids don't do that anymore." And I thought, wow. And when I really processed it, I thought to myself, the best things in my life, the best memories of my childhood are just not possible for this kid. And apparently, according to my friend, are not possible for most kids these days, or maybe all kids these days. And I just can't accept that. I'm not going to raise my kid that way. And so my first reaction was, well, I'm just going to buy a house in a great neighborhood that has lots of kids play, and I'll solve the problem. I thought it was a problem, I could just solve with money and moving. And I searched and searched, ended up searching for over 2 years for a house. And I never found a house in a great neighborhood that was available and with lots of kids playing. I just realized how difficult that was. It was almost impossible. But what I did find was a house that had the bones, had the infrastructure. It was very walkable, a lot of good destinations close by, calm street, lots of kids living in the area, not playing outside, but living in the area, kids, our kids' age. At the time, I had a four-year-old and a one-year-old, and we had thought maybe we'd have another kid. And I thought, well, that's the best I'm going to do. I'll move to this place, and it has a lot of things that we can make into a great place for kids to play. And that's really when I started Playborhood.
So yeah, that point you made about some of your greatest memories as a kid took part, like when you took part in unsupervised play with just your buddies, right? You're just by yourself with other kids. Like some of the, like I can, when you said that, like I started thinking back to my memories as a child, and yeah, like most of them happened like when I was like playing in a creek by myself with my friends, like there was no adult around.
Yeah, it's I don't want my parents to feel bad. They're passed away, or may they rest in peace. But yeah, my best memories, most of my best memories from my childhood are don't have any adults around. And I think there's a good reason for that. I think that we get an awful lot out of our parents that we treasure the rest of our lives, but they set us up for great experiences when they're not around. And that's when we really learn the most. That's when we grow the most. And those are the most memorable experiences. And boy, it's sad. Childhood is just not very good for most kids these days.
Well, talk about that. What's the problem like with kids not playing? Well, you know, people just say, well, the way kids are doing things now is just different. It's not better. It's not worse. It's just different. But you make the case that, no, actually, because kids aren't playing, there's some downsides to that. What are those?
Well, there are things that are the easy answers to that question are the measurable things. And so one of the things that a lot of people talk about is childhood obesity. Big problem. I don't know the exact statistics, but some very large proportion of kids is obese, just so heavy, so overweight that they can't even really exercise well. In some states in the United States, like Mississippi, I remember hearing it's over 30%. Of kids are obese, less so in other states, but still higher everywhere than it was decades ago. And that's measurable things. Things that are a little less measurable are their emotional state. There are some studies that have tried to compare kids today versus kids decades ago. There's just one study that where they give kids the same test, and they've been doing it since 1937 or 38, I think. And from that one study, giving the same test all these years, five times as many kids have emotional problems than had emotional problems back in the 30s and 40s. Five times. We also have an increase in child and teenage suicide. Big, big problem. And then there are things that are really not measurable at all, but I think are very, very important. The ability of kids to make rules, to adjudicate disputes when they have an argument with somebody, to bend to accommodate a kid who isn't as able, who maybe needs some special help. All these things, I group them into, you know, what you might call for a kid play skills, but as adults, we want adults to be able to solve problems, to create rules where there aren't good rules, to create a society that works for everybody. And these are the sorts of things we did, what I did with my friends when we played our own games of pickup baseball, pickup basketball, pickup two-hand tap football. We were doing that every day. We were, you know, deciding where to play. We were making rules because they were always a little bit different. We had arguments. We solved the arguments. We needed lots of kids to play. So we let kids play who weren't as able as us, and we bent the rules for them. So there was one kid in our neighborhood who was mentally disabled, and we wanted him to play softball with us. And there was no way he could strike out. He got as many strikes as he wanted, and we wouldn't try to get him out really fast. We would let him get to first base. These are the kinds of things we want our adults to do. And I think we could argue adults are not so good at doing these days compared to a few decades ago.
Yeah. And you mentioned all those things, those skills, right? Rule making, adjudicating disputes, making accommodations for kids with special needs. Nowadays, like adults do that for the kids. Like the adults make the decisions, and it's not no longer kid led.
No, it's no longer kid led. And so kids think that their job is to show up and, you know, to do what they're told. And, you know, not only is that not, you know, they're not learning a lot, but try this. And, you know, people who are listening, go to a field, and maybe you have kids who are in youth sports, go to a field and listen for how many cries of laughter, shrieks of laughter and joy that you hear It doesn't happen very often. It's pretty quiet. It's pretty serious. And I would argue it's just not that much fun. But, you know, if you have a group of kids who are playing on their own, you hear a lot more of that sort of thing. Kids are not growing and they're just not having as much fun as they used to.
But again, yeah, they're not having fun, but like when they're having fun with play, like as you said, they're learning some really important life skills.
It's a win-win. Yeah.
Right. Play. It's fun and it's also serious stuff and learning serious stuff. But let's talk about like why. Like why don't you hear those shrieks of laughter anymore when you drive through neighborhoods? What's happened, say, since, I mean, even when I was a kid, which was 30 years ago. Like what's changed since then?
Well, there are two ways to answer this question. And the most common way people answer the question is as a social scientist. Well, let's diagnose the problem. And, you know, a lot of people have answers and, you know, and they're essentially correct answers. We have TV now has 500 channels. We have the internet. We have mobile phones, iPads. We have a lot more activities than we used to. That's sort of the standard way to answer the question. And from a social science point of view, that makes a lot of sense. The problem with answering the question that way is that that leads you to come up with solutions that address those causes. And the solutions, if you frame the problem as too much of this, too much of that, too much of that, your solution is let's take them away. And so you hear a lot of parents saying, no, you know, we're going to cut out screen time, you know, only 1 hour a day, or we're not going to sign up kids for that many activities, and we're just going to push them out the door, and it doesn't work. It's, you know, we found out back in the late 80s, for those of us who are old enough, that, you know, Soviet style, you know, just withholding things from people doesn't give people a reason to change their behavior. It's just miserable. And that's what happens. You push kids outside without anything to do, and they look out in the neighborhood and there's nothing going on. So I like to frame the problem. I do agree, you know, they have too much screen time and, you know, too many activities, and, you know, that they need to be doing other things. But I'd rather frame the problem in terms of what are neighborhoods like today versus what were neighborhoods like decades ago. So if you push a kid outside, they look around. Neighborhoods are boring, aren't they? I mean, why would someone want to go out and play in their neighborhood today when there's nothing going on? It's, you know, it's an awful choice. So neighborhoods have kind of lost, or let's say they're losing in the competition for kids' attention. You know, if a kid has an extra hour in an afternoon, he or she is going to think, well, I could turn on my television. It's going to have something. I could turn on my iPad. I can play this game. It's going to work. It's going to be there. What happens if I go outside? There's a very, very low probability that anything's going on. And so they choose the video game, or they choose the television. So a lot of what the emphasis of playborhood is about encouraging parents, giving parents ideas, ways to make their neighborhood into an interesting place that actually is a competitor with television, with video games, with the other activities, so that the neighborhood is attractive to kids. And so that's the way I'd like to frame the problem.
And this way you frame the problem speaks to the network effect that you talk about in the book, about kids deciding whether they play or don't play outside. Right? So if there aren't any kids out there playing, no one's going to play. But if there are kids out there playing, then more kids are more likely to play.
Yeah, that sounds almost too simple, but it's actually an important concept. And the network effect is something that we see in a lot of, I studied economics, so I like to think this way. It comes very naturally to me, but if you think about, for instance, the different kinds of cell phone operating systems, there's really two. There's Android and there's iOS. You know, why are there only two? Well, there used to be Windows Phone. There used to be BlackBerry. There used to be actually a lot of others. Some companies have tried to promote their own new smartphone operating systems, but there's only two. Why is that? Because there's this network effect that if someone else uses iOS, that actually benefits me because I use iOS, because that means there will be more apps built for iOS. There'll be more Apple stores around where they can repair and they can solve my problems. And so I benefit from someone else's use of iOS devices. Well, the network effect works in neighborhoods like this. You would think that the decision the family makes about, let's say it's summer now, so what are kids doing in the summer? You would think that's a private decision that is just something that, you know, is no one else's business. But actually, if my neighbor's send all their kids to camp every day, that affects my kids' experience. That means that my kids really can't have a good time in the neighborhood during the day in the summer, during weekdays in the summer, because all the neighbor kids are out. So whether we like it or not, neighbors' decisions about what their kids do and the kids' decisions themselves actually have an effect on my kids. So there's this network effect. And what you find in a network effect situation is that there's two possible equilibria. One is nothing and the other is all or nothing. And so that's what happens with neighborhood play. You either have, if a kid wants to go out and is thinking about, hey, maybe I'll go outside and check it out and see if anybody's out there. If there's a low probability, but not zero, there's a 10% chance or 5% chance that someone's out there. Why bother? You know, they look outside, they look around. There's a 90% or 95% chance there's nothing going on. Most likely there's nothing going on. But if they turn on their computer, if they turn on their iPad, there's a 100% chance that they're going to have something to do. So a 10% or 5% or even 20% chance tends to crash down to zero, because no one wants to try if it's so low. On the other hand, if it's hopping, if something's happening all the time, then, you know, that's attractive. That people want to be there if there's something going on all the time. So there's this natural tendency to have all or nothing. And it's very important, because, you know, parents think, oh, if I put the little tyke slide in my front yard, I've done a good thing because I've given my kid something to do outside. But the truth is that because in this day and age, kids don't play outside very much or hardly at all in most neighborhoods, that making your neighborhood into a place where kids want to play, you know, and that's their choice to play, is actually really hard. You have to create critical mass so that kids have a hangout and they're showing up on a very regular basis.
Yeah. And so back, say when you were a kid or I was a kid, there were those hangouts, right? Like, yeah, there might have been some kid's house. Like, that was the hangout. You'd all just show up there and then you decide what you're going to do that day. Or you'd show up at a local park, or you'd show up at the creek. But yeah, that's not, there, a lot of neighborhoods don't have that anymore.
Yeah. And there's a term for it. I'll get a little academic on you again, but there's this term in sociology called a third place. The idea of a third place, put forth by a sociologist named Ray Oldenburg, is that human beings have, in history, have had, in general, three different places in their life that were the foundation of their social life. One, their first place is their home, where their family is. Their second place is their workplace or school, where they show up every day and they have that social group there. But then there's this third place, and the third place isn't so formal. It's a place that you show up when you want. And when you show up, there's almost always someone there who you want to see. You enjoy your time with them and you leave when you want to leave. And so for adults, the prototypical third place, at least in the late 20th century, was the Cheers bar. Those folks just showed up and they had instant social life, and they could count on there being somebody there that they wanted to see and they wanted to hang out with. For kids, well, for me, I had a stretch of street between my house and a house across the street where we played ball every day. There was a place in the woods, but there were these places that we just knew we could just show up. And we had a very high probability that, you know, there was going to be something going on. And today, these days, you know, kids still yearn for that. Almost no kids have that in the physical world. And so Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat have become the de facto third place for children today, and it's really sad.
So, do you have any idea like what critical mass is required in a neighborhood for like a playborhood to take root? Have you been able to figure that out or see anything?
Well, yeah, I wish I could give you an exact answer, but I'll give you my best answer by describing my neighborhood. You'll probably ask me about specifically what I've done to make my yard into a really compelling third place, a really compelling hangout for kids. But I think we've succeeded for the most part. And I would say for our yard, there are certain times of day, it's not all times of day, but certain times of day where it's quite likely that you'll find something going on. So right now it's 10 o'clock in the morning on a weekday and it's dead. There's nothing going on. And there usually isn't, at least on a weekday, on weekend days that there often is. But late afternoon, before dinner time, say 4 or 5 o'clock, there's almost always something going on. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One is my family has 3 boys, you know, and right now they're 10, 11, and 15. But growing up through the past few years, they've been very, very active being outside. Next door, we have a family of 3 boys, slightly younger ages. There are some, by the way, there's some houses very close to us, next door, another next door neighbor on the other side of us. They never show up here. They used to show up, but you know, we do have a good supply of kids here. And that's one of the reasons we moved here. And some of these kids, not all of them, become what I, you know, you could call the anchor tenants, the kids who are here almost all the time, and they form the foundation. And then other kids show up because they know that if they're not next door, they're a block away, 2 blocks away. If they come, there's going to be something going on.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now, and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining. On the pants, you can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy-to-follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. If you're like me, you've probably signed up for subscription services, but then you forgot about them. I'm talking about newsletters, streaming services, things like that. Well, with the personal finance app Rocket Money, it can help you find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions. It can also monitor your spending and help you lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. I had a chance to use Rocket Money, connected it to my checking account, and it found a bunch of subscription services that I forgot about. I was able to cancel them, and I was able to save a lot of money because the stuff adds up. Besides canceling your unwanted subscriptions, Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lower bills for you, up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness, rocketmoney.com/manliness.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere. This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans. That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn the art of negotiation from Chris Voss, we had him on the podcast, leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest, writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest, you name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss. And now back to the show.
Well, so let's talk about what you did in your house
to make it a, to encourage the playbook? Because I think this is interesting, because like what you're, what we, the end goal is like the kids are making the choices, right? And directing themselves. But in order for that to happen, the parents, it seems like, have to do, you know, set up an environment to make that happen, right? So what you did is you found it where there were kids, it was walkable. But then like, what did you do to get neighbor kids outside playing? Like what's there at your house that makes it attractive?
Well, I'll start by saying there are some purists out there, and I can understand this, purists of children's play, who say, oh my God, you did all this work. You shouldn't be doing that. You should just kick the kids outside and they should play on their own, because all kids really want to play. And, you know, I agree with that theory. The problem is we have a culture today in the 21st century, a children's culture that is antagonistic to play. You know, I talked about it before. There are so many different choices kids have, and other kids aren't playing. And it's very deeply ingrained in kids' minds that the play is not something that they see other kids doing. They don't see kids on TV doing it, playing in neighborhoods. So I have come to believe that parents need to do some work to set up the conditions. And then I like to think, and it's happened, it certainly happened in our case, that once you set those conditions up and create the cultural change in your neighborhood, then it has a life of its own. And we've seen that. So what have we done? So there's two main components to what we've done. There's the sort of the physical things we've done with our yard to make it into a very inviting place. And then the other side is just the social engineering, you will, of walking around, talking to people, kind of, you know, establishing the relationships and getting to know people in the neighborhood who, you know, most people don't get to know their neighbors like we have. So the first part, physical, the physical facility here, I live on it's 150 foot long by 50 foot wide lot. So that's 7,500 square feet. That's average where we live. I live in Menlo Park, California. So it's, you know, I guess kind of suburban. So it's big for a city lot, but it's not that big for a suburban lot. It's not that big. But what I did was I looked at our yard and I thought, I rethought literally, honestly, every square foot outside of our house. I rethought in terms of how we could use it, rather than how can I make it look like the other yards in the neighborhood, or how can I make it look right for selling the house? I don't plan on selling the house, but it's amazing if you sit and think about it, how people do not, they don't think about how to use their space outside their house. They're always thinking about, oh, what are the other neighbors doing? And they've got these shrubs and they've got these flower gardens and they've got all this stuff that actually isn't useful at all. So that's the highlight. What we've done is we have all sorts of great facilities. So in the front yard, first thing we did was I tore out the pavers. Pavers are these, you know, stones in our driveway, which the real estate agent will tell you, oh, it's luxurious and everybody wants pavers. Pavers are horrible for kids for a driveway because they're not smooth. And what do kids want to do on a driveway? They like to roll little wheels. They like to roll scooters, rollerblades. They like to ride bikes. They like to play basketball. They like to play bouncy ball. They like to draw with sidewalk chalk. All of that doesn't work on a driveway with pavers or bricks or gravel. Smooth. So I had the pavers taken out. We put smooth concrete there, as smooth as like we could get it. And that's paid many, many dividends over the years. We've also put in a picnic table in our front yard, not our backyard, because our backyard, where we live in Northern California, is fenced in. And for some reason, I grew up in a place where we didn't have any fences. I like seeing my neighbors. For some reason, where we live in Northern California, the custom is to put fences everywhere because for some reason you don't want to see your neighbors. I don't know. But when we eat outside, we like to see our neighbors. And so we have a lot of dinners in our front yard at our picnic table. And people walk down the street. They take walks in the evening. They take walks with their dog. And we almost always start a conversation with somebody. We see someone we know. It's very social. We have a lot of other things. We have whiteboard. We have 30 feet of whiteboard in the front yard. We have some public art, some mosaics that we've made with a local artist. We used to have a sandbox out there. We've taken away since our kids are older. We used to have a play river in the backyard. By the way, I'll say, I originally thought we're not doing anything in the backyard because we need to be out in front meeting people and seeing people. There's no good in us being in the backyard where people don't see us, but we've gotten a reputation. People gotten to know our yard, and we have space in our backyard. So we put some amazing things in our backyard, a huge playhouse that we do sleepovers in, an in-ground trampoline, ground level, which is much safer than a trampoline that's above ground. It's also a lot more fun. We have a play structure. We have a zip line. So we have a lot of critical mass. And you might say, oh my gosh, that's a lot of money. You know, that's a lot of resources. It is, but you need to consider we live in a neighborhood with very expensive homes, and kids have the most amazing electronics inside the houses that you can imagine. So we're in a competition. We're in a competition with every kid having a place where every kid has an iPad. Every kid has hundreds of channels of television. We've got a really compelling place. That's the physical facilities. On the other side, especially when my kids were younger, we were out playing in the street or in our front yard pretty much every day after dinner, some days before dinner, like in the winter, if I had the time to take off of work. We were out knocking on doors. We would very most likely walk to our grocery store or ride bikes to our grocery store rather than drive. We got to know our neighbors. We really spent a lot of time out there, and our kids became very comfortable being there. They got to know other people. We got to know people, even people that, you know, families that don't have kids, and a lot of empty nesters, older people, they've turned out to be great assets as well. For instance, about five houses down, there's a guy who is a hangover of the hippie generation. He's still got really long hair. He looks different, kind of scary to some people, but actually we've gotten to know him. He is a magician. He's a wonderful magician. He comes to our house a couple times a year still for parties. He's become a great asset, and a lot of neighborhoods have people like that that they probably don't even know about. So the two components are changing the physical facilities, and then also getting to know the people in the neighborhood very well and making our kids comfortable with them and getting to know the other kids who live in the neighborhood.
Yeah, I think that second component is really important. Some people might hear like, oh, I'll make my house a lot of fun, but it's not like if you build it, they will come, right? There also has a cultural change has to occur, and that takes a lot of, that'll take work, and it might take months, might even take years for it to take root.
I hate to say it, it takes years, but honestly, we've had fun every step of the way. And at this point, our kids are very self-managing. You know, I won't lie, there's chaos in our yard quite often, but there's hardly ever any real danger. And our kids can occupy themselves, have fun on their own, and they also go to other friends' houses. Another component I haven't even talked about is kids being independently mobile. We're very big on bikes. Biking, our kids do not get driven to school at all or picked up from school at all. They ride their bikes to and from school every day. And they're very able, as other kids in our neighborhood are, they're very able to go to other kids' houses without us hovering over them.
Well, let's go to this part about, you know, you mentioned that, okay, it sounds, you were just listing off all the things you did physically to change your house to make it more inviting for play. And you said, oh, that's a lot of resources. But what I like about the book is you also highlight other neighborhoods and other individuals who, you know, they are able to create a playborhood, but maybe didn't have to do what you had to do, but they're still able to do it with even limited resources.
Yeah, well, for instance, the book has a few chapters on other neighborhoods and has a chapter on my neighborhood. I also have a two-page spread on an apartment complex. And that was actually very easy to write because, you know, the apartments are, the apartments themselves are small. They don't have air conditioning. A couple moms just decided, you know, stay-at-home moms decided, you know, we're just going to put a chair outside every day during the summer, and we're going to sit around and chat. And the kids come out, and the mothers really don't have to do much at all. They, you know, someone just bought a TV. They put a cardboard box out. The kids play with the cardboard box all day. You know, they bring out a bunch of kitchen implements, and the kids are have a play kitchen that they've created. The amount of effort that parents have to do to get that play started depends on how much you have inside your house. You know, because like I said before, what we're really trying to do is we're trying to get the neighborhood to compete with what the alternatives the kids have. And so in a neighborhood where it's just a, there's just a courtyard in an apartment complex with small apartments. And if they don't have air conditioning, especially, it's very easy to get kids to go outside and play all day. There are other neighborhoods in between my neighborhood, which is a nice suburban neighborhood, and that apartment complex, very different examples from a really cool hipster neighborhood in Portland, Oregon, a new urbanist community in Alabama, and a very low income street in the South Bronx, which is generally considered to be one of the most dangerous and poorest places in the United States, that has an amazing play street that happens every day throughout the summer.
And also in the book, you highlight, besides making a place, a fun place for kids to hang out, in addition to that, it's that cultural component of just being outside all the time with your kids playing. So other families see, oh, this is something that's normal. We can do this too. You also highlight other things that families have done to promote that sense of cohesion, like just like one-time events. It could be like a movie night or something like that.
Yeah, well, I'm ambivalent about the one-time events, and let me explain. I think they could be really good. And a big thing that we do around here is we have these block parties. There's also, some neighborhoods will plan a play day for kids. Some neighborhoods will figure out a time just when they can block off their street. And it's not a block party, but it's just the different ways to do that. One neighborhood I know has done something like I've done. They've done a neighborhood summer camp for 1 week. They do it 1 week every year. And so these can be really, really good. I think that the hesitation I have is that I would say that the event is not the end in itself. It helps you create relationships and help you to start changing culture. But it just should be a catalyst, and the goal should be play every day or on a regular basis, at least a couple times a week. And if kids are not in that habit, then, they're going to have other habits. They're going to, the big question I have is, what do kids choose to do when they have some free time in an afternoon? What does their mind go? And I want them to be in the habit of doing things on their own. The events can be wonderful. My favorite, the last one I mentioned, the neighborhood summer camp can really change the culture of a neighborhood. And the cool thing about it is it's old school. It's just kids from the immediate neighborhood getting together for every day for 1 week and having a blast. The one that I write about in the book is a neighborhood where it's in Palo Alto, California, very close to where I am, where they've created a scheme of camp counselors counselors in training, junior counselors, senior counselors. So they've got throughout the teens, they've got all the kids with different kinds of roles, and they end up getting the kids all from 4 years old up to 17. And in this neighborhood, a couple of years, I remember asking them, well, 1 year I remember, of 65 kids who live in that neighborhood, they had 61 kids participate. And that's all the kids between 4 and 17. Really, to have that comprehensive participation means that everybody gets to know each other. And so when you're living your everyday life, you see people you see people you have a warm feeling for, and that creates a habit of repeated relationships, repeated play dates and get-togethers all year. So it's really an example of a catalyst that actually can have a lasting effect all year.
Well, here's another cultural problem that people might run up to or they think exists. So I think some people might be listening to this. Okay, that sounds great. I'm going to make my house awesome for kids to, hang out and play. But I'm worried about getting sued if like a kid falls off the roof of a treehouse. Is that a legitimate concern, or do you think it's overblown?
Well, I think it's a legitimate concern, but I don't think it's people should consider it a big enough concern to outweigh the benefit. There's a lot of legitimate concerns. Every time you step in your car and turn on the car and drive away, you're decreasing your life expectancy. Driving is a very dangerous thing, but we do it every day because we've decided that the benefits of driving are worth the costs. Well, it's the same thing with inviting kids with a lot of fun play facilities, even like a trampoline like we have. There's there's costs and there's benefits to doing that. I would say a few things about that. First of all, you can try to mitigate the risks. So one of the things we've done is we have a ground level trampoline versus a above ground trampoline. You can try to mitigate the risks, and you should do that, but you can't eliminate risks completely. You just can't. There's going to be risks in your yard. Another thing I'll say is that something remarkable happens if you have a real playborhood environment like we do, where kids are coming over on a regular basis. You find that, and this sounds sarcastic, but everybody kind of thinks when they first have kids that kids are crazy and all they want to do is dangerous things and hurt themselves. Kids actually don't want to hurt themselves. Kids actually think about their personal safety if you give them enough time with some situations that are potentially dangerous, and they'll sort of push their limits a little more every time. And what you find in our yard is the kids become very good at taking risks. We have a trampoline and we have kids jumping on it every day here. And we've had in 10 years, two accidents that required any sort of medical attention. Both of them were stitches, a few stitches in the lip or, you know, elsewhere on the face. That's, I think, a pretty remarkable record given the amount of activity we've had on this trampoline. But kids become very good at it. And pretty much every kid who comes here, who comes here for any length of time, learns how to do flips, front flips, back flips. We also have a two-story playhouse right next to the trampoline. They're jumping 10 feet, 12 feet down under the trampoline. They're doing really crazy, risky things, but they've learned how to take risks. And by the way, that's an important thing in life, because we want our kids to grow up and to try to get a raise, to try to start a new company. We want them to take risks in their careers. Well, they're learning how to do that in our yard, and they're being very successful at it. The last thing I'll say is about this question of risk and being sued is, you know, another thing we do is I try to get to know other parents, and I get to know pretty much all the parents of kids who come here. So I think it's less likely, becomes less likely because of that they're going to try to sue me. We also, we try to do things to mitigate the risk of kids having bad accidents with, you know, like an in-ground trampoline, but we're not going to wipe it out completely. So you end up with some probability of being sued. Let's compare that to the probability that my kids are going to have a better life, that they're going to have more fun, that they're going to have a wonderful childhood. That's probably 50%, 60%, 70%. I'll take those odds anytime. The probability of being sued, I don't know. It's 0.1%, 0.01%. I don't know what it is. The probability of them having a better life is 50, 60, 70%. I'll take those odds anytime.
And that's what umbrella insurance is for, probably. Right.
To be totally honest, I just don't like the insurance industry. I feel like they have a way of getting out of paying up in a lot of circumstances. I don't know exactly what my insurance covers. I have insurance. I have umbrella insurance, but I'm not counting on it. I'm just counting on, you know, I'm betting the odds that things are going to work out. And, you know, that's life. I mean, if you're really that afraid, you really shouldn't be driving a car.
Right, right. And speaking of that idea of risk, I mean, another reason why kids aren't playing outside is that parents are afraid that their kids are going to get abducted. All right, we've had Lenore Skenazy on the podcast to talk about this. Mm-hmm. And again, that's like, it's overblown. Right? It's not that big of a risk. It's okay. Your kid is like more likely to get struck by lightning than get abducted by a stranger.
Yeah. I mean, Lenore, that's her shtick is breaking that down and breaking that fear down and really getting people to not rate it so highly in their mind. They definitely overrate the possibility of that happening. The probability is not zero. The probability exists, but it's really low. And I think that the biggest problem is not that people are fearful, but that they actually they can't imagine that their kids could have so much fun. So what I found is parents that have various hesitations, they want their kids to be in activities all the time, or they want they're afraid their kids are going to get abducted. They bring their kids over our yard and they're just amazed at the joy the kids have and really playing with abandon that a lot of kids just don't have in their lives today. And parents need to experience that. And I think that will really wither away the hesitations that people have that seem irrational.
So when I was a kid, one of the things that we did was play capture the flag at night. And that involved, you know, it was like all the neighbor kids in the street. And like we would be hiding in neighbors, you know, garden beds on the side of their house in their backyard, like jumping over fences. And like the parents didn't, like no one cared because like all the parents, like those were their neighbor kids' houses, right?
Yeah.
So there was a buy-in. The parents didn't care. I imagine if that happened today, like there'd be people on the Nextdoor app, right, complaining about there's kids jumping my fence. How do you, how do you get buy-in from neighbors who don't have kids, right? And it sounds like it's not that big of a problem because you mentioned the magician guy. Is that an issue where, you know, creating a playground where you have neighbors who don't have kids, they're just like, I don't want that. It's too much ruckus, too much noise.
Well, I'll say this. So generally speaking about, I want to make a comment about the neighbor reaction. So, you know, just like a lot of things in life, there's kind of a bell curve distribution. We have on the one end, people who are the least enthusiastic. And the other end, we have people who are the most enthusiastic. And in the middle are people who, you know, they kind of like it. They think it's pretty cool, but it's not going to, you know, it's not going to change their lives in any measurable way. But the first end of people who aren't enthusiastic, for the most part, they're not against us. They're not antagonistic to what we're doing. It's that we just don't have any impact on their life at all. They blow by us. They don't think about us. We're just these weird people who are doing something different. We don't really upset them. I do have one neighbor who, an older woman, and who lives with her husband, they're, I guess in the early 70s, I would say. She's a very nice person, nice to talk to. And she came up to me and she basically said she doesn't think our kids should be playing on the street, riding their bikes, riding their scooters. And we live on a street that's very calm. I've actually, cause I'm a geek about kids play, and I've written this book. I actually have spent time counting cars, and you know, it ends up being about one car every couple minutes, which isn't bad. You know, one car every 2 minutes, 3 minutes, something like that. But she just thinks kids should not be on the street, and I tried to listen to her, and I said, "Well, I'll do this for you. I or some other adult will be on the sidewalk, keeping an eye on our kids when they're in the street, but I'm not going to tell our kids they can't go in the street." And quite honestly, I feel like the street is as much our kids as any car that goes by. It's all our, it's everybody's property. It's not the sole domain of any car that wants to pass by. And she wasn't happy about that. And we're not real friendly these days. Yeah, I feel a bit bad about that, but I'm just not going to give up. I'm not going to tell my kids they can't play in the street. I think that it's, if you really stop and think about it, why is it that, you know, that some people think that cars have total carte blanche to do whatever they want on streets, no matter what street it is. You know, if it's an interstate highway, I get it. But a street that gets a car every 3 or 4 minutes, you know, I think kids have as much right to it as cars do.
Yeah, man. If I couldn't play in the street when I was a kid, like there'd be no street hockey. There wouldn't have been any baseball games because that's where we played.
Yeah.
Yeah. The street. And it, like, it wasn't that big of a deal. As soon as the car came, you said game off, like on Wayne's World, went to the side, car passed, and you went back to playing. It was not a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll tell you, to be honest, some people, neighbors might not like this, but there was my kids have on and off played street hockey in the street in front of our house for years, and they're not doing it right now, but they'll probably start this fall again. There was a time we were playing a lot, and we put the goals right in the middle of the street. And when a car would come, I did not run really fast to grab the goal. I'd take my good old sweet time, and I'd grab that goal. And I nice and easy walk, you know, pulled that goal off to the side. I made the driver know that, you know, this is not a great street to pass through. and you know, that's the kind of thing my friends and I did. We didn't like cars passing through. We felt we didn't feel like we owned the street, but we felt like, hey, you know, this is our place. And maybe you might want to take another route the next time you think about driving through a neighborhood.
And to this point of, you know, having these difficult conversations, like that's part of being in a community. Oftentimes when people think about a community, they always think of the happy stuff, like the day camp that moms put on, and it's great. But like the other part of being in a community is it takes work and it requires having those difficult conversations. And it might mean like you're not friendly with some people, but it's something you got to do if you want to have that larger goal you're aiming for.
Yeah. I'm it's obvious in life. You don't always need to capitulate to someone else's demands. I think it's important that you listen to someone, you try to, you know, meet them partway. But, you know, I have this fundamental belief that streets are not just for cars, especially, like I said, streets where there's not a lot of traffic. And, you know, I'm very happy to say that our kids feel totally comfortable in our yard, in the street, going to other people's houses. It's a place where it's their domain. It's a place that they feel very comfortable doing anything they want.
So, Mike, I wonder if you have any advice to say, like, there's one thing that someone can start doing today, a parent who's listening to the show, that they can start making a playbook happen in their neck of the woods. What would you say that one thing could be, like the step in action they can take right now?
Well, I like to use the adage that is often attributed to Woody Allen. I read that he said someone else said it first, but he's often quoted as saying 80% of life is showing up. And there's different ways to interpret that, but the way I like to interpret it in this context is, you know, show up in your neighborhood. Where do you show up as parents? Do you show up in front of the television set every day after dinner? Are you, you know, working after dinner, going off into your study? If you show up in your neighborhood with your kids out front, if you're walking and biking to nearby places like the grocery store or to the park rather than driving, if you're showing up at neighbors' houses, knocking on the door, chatting with them, then your kids will definitely get the sense that this is normal. This is a place that is worthy of my parents' attention, and this is worthy of my attention as well. So I say show up in your neighborhood as often as you can.
Awesome. Well, Mike, is there some place people can go to learn more about the book and your work?
Well, there's the book, Playborhood, available on Amazon.com. The website, I haven't been blogging for the past couple of years, but there's a bunch of, there's a couple hundred blog articles on Playborhood.com. By the way, I guess it's not so easy to find, but there's lots of disciples of Playborhood, lots of instances of people trying to create Playborhoods throughout the United States. And in the book, there's examples of other neighborhoods we just touched on briefly. Each of those is really fascinating in its own right. For instance, I mentioned this place in Portland, Oregon called Sherritt Square, and it's part of a city repair movement. That's one of many examples that are just fascinating for different ideas, different approaches to how to create a great place for play for kids.
Awesome. Well, Mike Lanza, thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Brett, thank you so much.
My guest today was Mike Lanza. He's the author of the book Playborhood. It's available on Amazon.com. You can also find out more information about his work at his website, playborhood.com. Also, check out our show notes at aom.is/Playborhood. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM podcast. Check out our website at artofmanliness.com, where you find our podcast archives, as well as thousands of articles we've written over the years on parenting, how to dress better, health and sports, fitness, you name it, we've got it. And if you'd like to enjoy ad-free episodes of the Art of Manliness podcast, you can do so on Stitcher Premium. Go to stitcherpremium.com, use code manliness at checkout to get a month free trial of Stitcher Premium. Once you're signed up, you can download the Stitcher app on Android or iOS and start enjoying ad-free episodes of the Art of Manliness podcast. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate it if you take 1 minute to give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member who you think would get something out of it. As always, thank you for the continued support. Until next time, this is Brett McKay, reminding you not only listen to the AOM podcast, but put what you've heard into action.